Okay, I want to talk about what central mass concentrations do to the structure and evolution of galaxies. And usually we call them black holes or central mass concentrations, but since this is the workshop on black holes, we're going to call them black holes, but they can be just central mass concentrations. This is an interesting subject, I think, where one can look at sort of secular processes, which are slow and act over time, and occasionally you reach a threshold and an interesting sort of transition or catastrophe occurs. It's a bit like water dripping on a stone, where, you know, over many eons you just have a tiny effect, and then in the end the stone is either, it shatters or just disappears. And there can be interesting effects on on galaxies from the growth of central mass concentrations. And the easy one to deal with is the two-dimensional one. It's not the one I started with. The first one was ellipticals, but we'll do the easy one first. We'll probably, that's about as far as we'll get with a normal barrage of questions. But in a normal environment, I would then discuss sort of what happens in the centers of triaxial galaxies like ellipticals. Some kind of general comments about the fundamental plane and the relation of galaxies, and how one might look at, you know, a more generalized fundamental plane that includes the properties of these central mass concentrations. Then I wanted to make some remarks on feedback and tell you what I did a while ago on feedback, and then and this is an argument which is completely turned around from the arguments which are now currently being discussed, where one wants to explain, you know, the Megorian plot, the relationship between the black hole mass and the galaxy from feedback in these types of equations, and I'll explain why. And one was trying to get properties of the galaxies from the, you know, what happened in the center, global constraints on the properties of galaxies. And then a couple of remarks on fueling, about trying to bridge the gap between the 100 parsecs and the 0.1 parsec type range when you begin to start with accretion disks, and some comments on this idea about double bars where we've done some simulations. So what's this all about? Well, the secular evolution effect is essentially, in most of these cases, is because you have a symmetry breaking. Essentially, spherical central mass concentrations make Keplerian, nice round Keplerian type orbits, whereas galaxies very often in their center, say in barred galaxies, which are, you know, at least 50% of all galaxies, don't have that sort of nice round symmetry. They have additional integrals of motion which lock them into these shapes which are bar-like, or in the case of ellipticals, are triaxial. And it's the interplay between popping in something with a spherical symmetry to into a region which has these additional integrals and does not have a spherical symmetry, and how that symmetry is broken, and how it leads to chaos, and then how it leads to interesting evolution is what I'm going to discuss. So this is the basic idea for disks. And then I'll show you how we analyzed it. So the idea is that you have some kind of disk, right? And in it, you have slow gas accretion. You might have a proto-disk, and clouds are falling in. And then, I'm at a point. And then, if you build up the mass sufficiently, it may go bar unstable. So that's pretty well understood. This criterion is not perfect, but it's a useful sort of engineering guide. And then the idea for a long time has been that, you know, such larger distortions in the potential will help produce gravitational torques, which will then drive material into the central region and start growing a central mass or a black hole, and or a black hole. And what we wanted to show, well, we investigated this, and what we found was that once the central black hole had grown sufficiently large, that its sphere of influence, which is GM over sigma squared, it's okay to, yeah, it's sort of like the sphere of influence of the black hole. Once that had gone out to something like the inner Lindblad resonance of this bar essentially dissolves, and I want to show you that, how that works. But then this is the big story at the moment. what we found further when we did three-dimensional calculations with Selwood was that not only did the bar dissolve in the plane, but also when you dissolve a bar in a rotating system, sort of you lose these additional integrals of motion, and what you've got left is the energy services, or more precisely the Jacobian E minus omega J is still conserved, and that the particles then fill a large surface, which is three-dimensional, and this begins to look, and I'll show you later, very like a bulge. Okay, so what happens here is that you have some gas build-up, bar formation, black hole formation or central mass formation, then dissolution, and then it can start again. You sort of build the bulge, you dissolve everything, you have your disk, and then more gas can fall in and this cycle can repeat. The question is how many cycles. Some people are arguing at the moment that there's only one. That's Hans Walter Rix is the main proponent of that, based on some timescale estimates. But it's not clear. I mean, you have a lot of interesting things about galaxies. Bulge building, you know, sort of an onion skin model type process, and cycles of activity obviously occurring. Now, how does one go about technically calculating this sort of thing? Well, the first thing you do is you run single particle orbits in bar type potentials, and you look at phase space. In 2D, the situation is relatively simple. You've got four dimensions in phase space, and you've got an energy integral, and you can take cuts, two-dimensional cuts in phase space, and plot them, and these are some of the cuts. And you can classify the orbits. The orbits are beautiful. You have to believe it. Here are some of the orbits. You classify all the different types of orbits in the potential, and then you see in this two-dimensional representation what percentage of the orbits are filled at any given time depending on the central mass concentration, because that's affecting the bar. And I'll show you a plot of the run of that in a minute, but essentially these are the major orbits which are holding up the bar. These are the B orbits. So here's the bar here. Don't have to turn the light on. And the B orbits are the ones that go round with the bar, okay, and they sustain the bar. The other family are ones that sort of do this, and I'll get to those later on in the talk. And then you have special families of orbits. And what we found after doing single particle calculations only, and this is mainly Hassan who knew how to do these calculations, was that the percentage of phase space sort of occupied it by the fundamental orbits, these B-type orbits, decreased as you increase the black hole mass to total mass of the system. And as the black hole mass varied, it looked like this. So we were guessing that at some point, 5 or 6%, then the bar might do something interesting. But this was only single particle calculations. So there was a prediction there. So I called up, I said, who's the best calculator in the world of these things self-consistently? So I phoned up Jerry Selwood. And I'll turn the microphone off now, tell you the story. No. So he found it, found some interesting effects after a while. These, I think, were some of the first calculations he ran. Essentially, you're just running one of his quiet start barred galaxies. And here, I believe the mass is, yeah, the bar is still there, so this is no central black hole mass. This is 3% and 5%. And you can see that as you switch on, what we do is we switch on the black hole mass somewhere in this region, and this is just the beginning of the explanation. There's a lot more coming if you're still awake. And you can see that the bar then is dissolved as we switch on a few percent, or easily as you switch on 5%. And it's consistent with this estimation from the phase space in two dimensions, and that's four phase space dimensions minus the energy constraint, which is three phase space dimensions essentially. So we looked at these simulations. It was possible to analyze the phase space, again, from the simulations. Now, when you're running in-body simulations and you're trying to do orbits, they truly look awful. The single particle, the orbit calculator in an in-body simulation, certainly, you know, these are your orbits, essentially. And so you have to take significant averages, or you have to stop the run at some point and then do single particle orbits in a smooth potential, and that's what we did in order to get some idea of phase space. But we also saw how the phase space, let me just, the phase space of the system was dissolving. It's sort of hard to see here, but these are not the orbits from the n-body calculation. It's not the strict phase space, because that would be much too noisy to see anything realistic. It's the, you stop the potential and then run the orbits, and this is what we got. So here it is with no central mass, and you can see the effect, if you look carefully, as the central mass grows. Just compare the two bottom, this guy and this guy. Okay. So as the black hole grows, you're beginning to dissolve these orbits. The interesting thing was, remember we had this prediction here in 2D from single particle orbits, and it came out full self-consistent calculations to be this. And the parameters we're using for the bar, the halo, the disk, etc., are pretty canonical. So it looked like, interestingly enough, that a few percent might do the job. And remember, this is a few percent of the, essentially, the bar mass, or the mass interior to the bar. So it's, you know, down by a factor of, you know, 5 to 10 on the Megorian-type plot, where you're comparing the mass of the central object with the entire bulge mass of the galaxy. Okay, so that you get, in principle then, what I'm saying, which is important to remember, is that there have been lots of arguments about, and lots of discussion about, the famous Megorian plot, where you relate the central mass concentration to the bulge luminosity, or the bulge mass, and what is the reason for that, and there may be a number of reasons, but this one looks at least not inconsistent with the data, and it's a purely dynamical effect. Okay, here's the n-body simulations in their full glory, as done by Hassan and Selwood, and you can see here that, and this is for, it's the 5% one, so the effect is the strongest that we calculated. You have the bar, and then you switch it on. You switch on the black hole mass around here, and you see it's dissolved quite rapidly. And what you need also to remark is, remember I said that the particles then fill the energy surface if you do the single particle calculation, but in fact, if you look at the disk structure, this is a 3D simulation, if you look what's happening to the disk, it's fairly flat until you get to later times, and you're growing the bulge. You're actually heating the particles from the plane into the bulge. So you're not only turning off the activity and dissolving the bar, but you're also, in principle, growing the bulge. Okay. Now, yes, it's done about here, and it's not impulsive, but it's over a rotation time or so, right? But we worried about that, whether it should be adiabatic or impulsive, and it's sort of intermediate. Yeah.
It's growing the black hole rather in body, not relying on gas dynamics to get the mass.
No, there's no no one has done. You have to do highly accurate n-body to get this right. So no one has done the highly accurate gas dynamical n-body calculation that does this. We're putting this in by hand, although there are many other simulations that show that gas flows into the center. We decided to stick to trying to see what the dynamical effects were. Yeah.
Sure,
yep.
But I guess what's the description for the growth of the black hole back of these simulations? What is the description you use?
Well, essentially what you have to understand, that this is what we're showing is a transition that occurs at a few percent, a few to 5%. So we don't worry so much It doesn't look like it matters too much how the gas actually, the prescription, it doesn't matter too much what the prescription is as long as you hit that threshold, right? So that's the current wisdom. I mean, it may be wrong, and I suspect in the next year or two we can do better simulations. I don't like SPH much for this, and we do have a code now that WADA has developed, which is not SPH. It's a finite difference and has one parsec type resolution and could be used to study this problem, although we're doing something else with it at the moment.
Are the n-values conserved? Do you go from one picture to another, or do you just crank up the
right order? In this case, we also have, this is getting into the murky details, but we fixed the spheroidal halo that it's in the dark matter potential, and we sort of take the black hole out of the dark matter potential, so we kind of conserve that, but we keep the n-bodies constant. And this is this is what happens to the amplitude of the bar component, the m equals 2 component. We were discussing the other day how you might do QPOs, etc. So we did the Fourier analysis on this disk. And you see that for no central mass, nothing happens. You keep the bar. This one here is 3%. You're beginning to dissolve it. 7%. There's a very sharp transition that occurs like that. Now, I can say that other people who do extremely good n-body gas dynamic work, Barnes and collaborators, have done this to some extent in 3D, and if you remind me, I'll tell you about it. Paolo reminded me yesterday to mention it. But they get the same type of symmetry breaking effect. Okay. And we're often asked what this looks like. Does it look like an exponential disk? And the answer is not inconsistent with, but not obviously. But here, we plot the surface density of the particles at the end of the run. It's not so bad. It might actually be an exponential disk, which is what spirals have. And this thing looks like a boxy sort of bulge, which is often associated with central mass concentrations. But these diagrams are suggestive. They're not accurate proofs yet. I'm sorry? No. No, it's just an arbitrary profile. It tends to go towards that. But I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is this is suggestive, right? We need to do much higher resolution calculations to prove that. But it's an interesting suggestion. What else did I want to say about disks? Any questions about disks at the moment before I head off into ellipticals? No.
Is there a simple explanation of why the bar dissolves? I came a little late.
Yeah. No, I didn't. Well, I was looking for an explanation that said the orbits go chaotic when resonances overlap, and didn't find it. Right, but what does happen is, I think I mentioned, maybe you can let, but when the sphere of the influence of the black hole, which is of order this, right, where you have the Keplerian orbits, type orbits, then when that crosses the inner Lindblad resonance of the bar, right, which is a classic, I mean, here, resonance for a bar. Here you have omega for a bar, and here you have omega minus kappa over 2, which is the epicyclic type, the two-armed resonance, which allows the bar to be sustained. Then you have various resonances that occur. This is co-rotation, outer inner Lindblad resonance, and inner inner Lindblad resonance, and other things. And so when this resonance, which is important, this is the pattern speed of the bar, when this resonance is crossed by the sphere of influence of the black hole, it dissolves. Now, it's not a Chirikov-type argument. It just says that something's going on between, I'm destroying the important inner resonance of the bar. But I was looking for something much more profound and couldn't find it. I still wish, I think it's probably still there. It's just that I can't find it.
That's also what Selwood and Moore say.
That's right. Yeah. Well, we actually...
It was looking for what you were searching for. Well,
the history is interesting. We went to see Jerry one day and said, is it this? And we thought it might be. And then he said, no, it wasn't. And then several years later, he and Moore decided that it was again. But it's something like, engineering-wise, this is what happens, right? But there's a deeper explanation, which would be fun to look at.
Well, is it too simple just to say the black hole doesn't like uniform rotation, it wants Kepler's law.
Yeah, that's the simple version. But, you know, Chirikov wrote this beautiful paper on the approach to chaos and overlapping resonances and period doubling and all sorts of things. And, you know, one wants to... We're crazed by getting the physics right, everybody in this room. Right? So what happened... So the question is, next, what happens to round things like ellipticals? Massive ellipticals are triaxial. They do have this interesting... structure where there are ellipsoids A not equal to B not equal to C in the central regions, and in there are what's called box orbits, which do not, you know, have nice elliptical shapes, but tend to fill this whole region of space in the core of the galaxy. And this was quite interesting, and this is because Tim DeZayo was a student in Leiden when I was a younger and much lighter assistant professor in Leiden. and he was doing interesting work on sort of models of these things. So then I got interested in the entire problem from this three-dimensional point of view. There are a number of issues there. At that time, it was supposed that there was a loss cone when you had a black hole and a system of n points around it. You fueled the hole by having radially plunging orbits go near the hole, get tidally disrupted and fall into the system. And the problem was, after you depleted those radially plunging orbits, it took a relaxation time in order to renew them. Now, obviously, in a system like this, which does not have these symmetries, then, of course, the timescale is much faster, and it turns out to be, if epsilon is some measure of the triaxiality, the dynamical triaxiality, then it's very rapid replenishment, not on a relaxation time, but on a time scale, which is T dyne over this characteristic dynamical asymmetry. So that allowed for more rapid fueling of these systems. And there's other interesting problems to do with gas dynamics, which I won't actually go into. And in this case, I said that for the two-dimensional potential, the GM over sigma squared was roughly the inner Lindblad resonance here of the bar. What happens is that when GM over sigma squared reaches roughly the shortest scale of the box, right, A, B, C, C being shortest, then the whole thing is dissolved.
Colin,
yeah.
There was great enthusiasm for fueling quasars with tidal disruption.
Yeah.
And basically, the Loscombe killed that off. So why haven't we heard more?
This is well known in the field. I mean, this gives you a boost of a factor of 10, but even then, it's not... the stellar densities required to fuel, even in the Loscombe case, were enormously high. Here, they're lowered by a factor of 10, but they're still high. Okay, so this isn't probably the answer, but it's interesting. It's sort of well known in the field that it doesn't work perfectly. Now... okay, so, yep, the box gets destroyed. I mean, at least that's the, you might believe that after the introduction anyway, the box gets destroyed, and the galaxy begins to respond. And these are triaxial galaxies. There are what's called sort of tube orbits out here, which fill big AM surfaces and big tubes, and they remain fairly stable, but there are orbits that still plunge through the center, which come from out here. And what the guess is, and nobody's done this, Merritt has done beautiful work on single particle calculations in the central regions, and you know, following what we did earlier on, and found that there, if you change the potential by introducing a black hole, then there's lots of interesting chaos. But that really isn't the question. Right, and to some extent, the similarity of the two-dimensional analytic calculations to the two-dimensional n-body calculations surprised me. The real question is this: that when you have a transition to chaos in the central region in the way that I've described, or any way, how does the potential actually respond? And let's see if I can. Okay. I'm getting ahead of myself, but I'll continue on this track. How does the potential respond? Does it respond to continue to build up chaotic orbits? Or does it respond to minimize the chaotic orbits? Or does it respond to, you know, do something else? It's the self-consistency that really counts. That is, del squared phi equals 4 pi g rho has not been included in nearly all of the calculations where you see this transition to chaos, and except in 2D. And so we don't know whether the orbits in real potentials, right, which are truly accessible in a dynamical sense, where you're solving Poisson's equation as well, whether the orbits remain chaotic or sort of get wiped out by the tendency of a dynamical system to want to go to much more regular structure and regular integrals. And, well, that's a really profound question in dynamics, but it does relate to have very important consequences in this type of astrophysics. So anyway, what happened? Well, a long time ago, we got hold of the Cray in Munich, which is about equivalent to a laptop these days. And with Van Albada and May doing all the work and me enthusing, we found that when you had this dissolution of the triaxial system, then you got an interesting roundening structure. That is that the galaxy rounded by about two ellipticity classes. It went from E, well, in this case it's probably one, I probably lied. It went from E 4.0, 4.1 to E 3.0. So the whole galaxy got rounder. So why did it do this? Well, it did it because this goes rounder, we've discussed that, and it's just like the two-dimensional case, I think. But then orbits out here come through, they don't actually pass that close to the center, but they see a somewhat rounder potential. And they get scattered a little bit. They're on their own, you know, nice triaxial elliptical orbits, but they feel this slightly rounder potential, so they just get scattered a little bit, and then they go out again, and they go back to a slightly different part of that that orbit. And then gradually the rounding potential moves out. The best calculation of this in recent years has been done in a different way, which Paolo reminded me of, which is Barnes et al., who effectively dropped very large gas masses, round gas masses, into the central regions of elliptical galaxies, which were triaxial that they were forming, and watched them go round. Right, so this was... this was during their beautiful simulations where they take two galaxies and they have them fly apart and there's tidal torques, mass falls to the center, and then they have them come back together, merge, etc. But in effect, they saw this interesting transition as they destroyed the triaxiality of these galaxies by dropping in a very large mass, wiping out the box orbits, and then seeing the thing go round. And that's the best calculation done so far. Technically, it's difficult. Currently, Hernquist, Mihos, Sigurdsson, and me are trying to calculate this using somewhat different techniques, and we'll hope to tell you the answers in January when we have a meeting on galaxy formation. Okay. Well, I've said this, but in general, is this all both for the rounds, for the triaxial elliptical galaxies, and for the barred galaxies? The conjecture that's interesting and fashionable at the moment is some of this tight correlation between central mass and global properties of galaxies due to internal dynamical processes, and it's certainly plausible. It's certainly interesting to investigate, and as I've indicated there, a number of really interesting dynamical calculations to do on the way. So, the third topic here is... Oh, any questions about round systems?
Yeah. Before you go to that first one, so you do have an explanation with McCoy and Al relation for spirals, but not for elliptical.
Yeah, it's the same. They're displaced, of course, because the criterion are different, and
right.
They still have a threshold, but what's the hard part?
You could convert it into a mass threshold. You could
Yeah.
Did you show that for this galaxy?
Yep.
I didn't see that for
elliptical. It's the same criterion. I mean, it's that you're destroying the central box. Yeah.
It's
Right, exactly right, yeah. Well, this turned out to be, in the old days, this was 5%. Right. But what you have to do then, and this is why I haven't quantitatively tried to get the Megorian plot, because it's truly messy, because you have to go from there, from the core, out to, you know, the bulge, the whole thing. And there's all sorts of twiddles on the way. Okay. Secular evolution is fascinating. You can probably see it with big surveys, Sloan, etc. You can probably see it with Hubble, NGST, etc. If you have enough galaxies, you can watch, you know, the various evolutionary processes, bulge building, bar dissolution, etc., as the universe evolves. And how do you approach this? What do you do? Well, Marcella Carollo has been doing a lot of work on this at Hopkins, and she has very interesting NICMOS data, which I won't go into since it's not yet published or pre-printed, but she'll tell you about it if you ask her. The way to approach this, I think, is to add some additional parameter to the fundamental plane idea, that galaxies seem to lie on a fundamental plane, which is, you know, partly the virial theorem, but partly contains some information, which is essentially luminosity, characteristic scale, and velocity dispersion. And there have been a number of attempts to relate, you know, the core properties to the global properties. One's heard many things, I think, from Richstone, etc., about cusp laws and masses of galaxies, masses of black holes, etc. But generally speaking, one wants to look at this in a slightly new way, because if you believe that either from internal dynamical processes or from external feedback processes, that the tight relation between the central mass of the whole and the global properties of galaxies is real, then you should be able to find it in looking at either the approach to the fundamental plane or just looking at the data. And so I was advocating this in Leiden last couple of weeks ago, where there are very hard-headed observers, you know, Marianne Franks, Tim DeZeo, etc., were there, and they said there's only six. Well, he has hard-headed observers working with him, right? They said there's only six galaxies you can do this with, right? So the sample isn't big enough to actually extract the information about the relation to the more global properties. But it, when done, it will give us clues to how this process might be working. In particular, you'll see this a little more when I get to feedback properties of galaxies. But this is just data crunching in a way that's well known. It's just there isn't enough data. That is, you do the principal component analysis, but you include here central mass. Okay. And then you hope to find things. Okay. Well, that was the... believe it or not, that was supposed to be the elegant part of the talk, and now we'll get to gas dynamics, which gets pretty messy. Now, I spilled coffee on my shirt on purpose, you know, so it's not very elegant. I want to discuss a topic which Roger approached me on day one when I was here. I'd been here 10 minutes. He said, what we should do is explain the Megorian plot by feedback. Okay, I thought, I did the problem in exactly the opposite way a few years ago. I should explain this and then say why it's a good idea to do what you and Piero are thinking of doing. So I want to talk about feedback of AGN on the global sort of structure, essentially, of proto-galaxies and what that sort of indicates for the structure of the galaxies, etc., things we've been discussing. Well, to start off with, we have to take a basic model of some kind of proto-galaxy. And I did that a while ago with Satoru. We looked at sort of a quiescent proto-galaxy with a multi-phase medium. Clouds were in the medium. There was an interphase medium which contained all the energy. The clouds contained all the mass. Every time a cloud collided under this incredibly simplistic proto-galaxy, you formed stars and injected some energy. So 10% of the mass of in a collision was formed. 10% of the, when you collided the clouds, you made 10% of that into stars. That is what's commonly called the star formation efficiency of 10%. Then, after a while, supernova went off, heated the hot phase, etc. And here are some of the parameters. The cold phase has a cold phase has a density of about 100. Temperatures cool, 10 to the 4th. Cloud sizes are, let's see, it's about 100 parsecs. Masses, 10 to the 6th, etc. Right, so you can, so there's at least a basic model. And into this model, it was just to get a basic model, essentially. And into this model, we injected some active galaxies, you know, the things that happen at high redshift, mostly, two galaxies. You form them. That's a starburst. There are quasars. There are radio galaxies. There are AGNs, etc. Broad absorption line systems with outflowing winds. And, There were lots of things to say, but I won't. Oh, those are for questions. Okay, so why is this interesting? Why would you even want to do something that crazy? Well, it turns out that if you look at sort of the binding energy of galaxies and the energy that's required to produce all the metals in a galaxy and the energy that's pumped out by quasars given some duty cycle and radio sources and BALs given some duty cycle, then it depends where you were trained, but it all comes out to be sort of 10 to the 60 plus or minus 2. And, if you're a condensed matter physicist, you might say that there's no similarity at all. But in fact, I suspect that there is some kind of reason why all these things are the same, and it is due to some feedback. Okay. Now, what we did was to take sort of the accretion energy that's going into the system. The luminosity that you're radiating, that you have to radiate to form any gravitationally collapsing system, is sigma to the 5th over g, right? Which is the luminosity. Something like, sorry, is there a question?
I was wondering what eval was, is that?
Broad absorption line, yeah.
Okay, so the kinetic energy associated.
Yeah.
Okay, got it.
Yeah. So these things all turn out, to be the same. And it's whether we put the duty cycles in to get 10 to the 60 ergs or not, right? So anyway, in any self-gravitating system, the luminosity that you're radiating when it's collapsing, even if it's from a star to a galaxy, is sigma to the 5th over g. It just depends on your binding energy. And in a sense, you have to radiate that in order for this to happen. So we take sigma to the 5th over g as it needs to cool. This is the famous cooling function. This is the famous cooling law. And you need to balance out. And the other thing you need to balance out is not only the cooling, but the momentum, because you're injecting photons, you're injecting large kinetic energy and BAL winds, radio sources, etc., starbursts, these famous outflows that have been seen in starbursts, and you actually get the momentum balance right. And this is where we diverge from Roger's approach, but this was some time ago. So I said, if you do any work in the interstellar medium and you see a sigma to the 5th, you immediately take the 1/5 power and try to get a robust result. All right, so what we did here was essentially that. We said that we're balancing these things, this is a high power, what can we calculate? And the answer was we could sort of calculate the binding energy of galaxies that are needed to survive these enormous catastrophes that are occurring in the center. And it turned out to get, a few hundred kilometers per second, depending on what the luminosity and the velocity of the input was. So we got a robust estimate for the binding energy of galaxies, and that's as far as it went. We would have liked to close the loop by attempting to relate this L here to something that's happening in the center, such as, the Eddington luminosity. But at that time, I think we had a conversation with several famous people doing AGNs who said the Eddington luminosity has nothing to do with anything. So we didn't make that calculation. Now, what's possible, and this is why I think Roger got excited about this, was that what's possible is that you can relate the black hole mass to the total mass, and you can get a feedback by assuming something like an Eddington luminosity. So it's observationally inspired, you can close the loop and attempt to do these calculations again, and then maybe get some reason why there's a relationship, a coefficient here. And I think Piero and Roger were thinking about this, and Martin Rees and Joe Silk published a paper on, let's see, I have to turn the microphone off. Right. They published said, I believe was that, what Silk and Rees said was that you take the sigma to the fifth over G and you equate it to the Eddington luminosity, you know, so that then you equate it to M, right? And so then you get a relationship between binding energy and M central. I haven't read their paper, but this is, I assume, what they did. And and then of course you can always relate because there's an L sigma to the fourth relation for galaxies. It's sigma to the fourth, sigma to the fifth, or sigma to the cubed, depending on whether you're intermediate type mass range, high or low. But there's a nice relationship between L and sigma, so it's Q, right, something like that. And so then, because you've got a sigma M central relation, then you just get an L to the quarter M, you know, with an L M to the four-fifths type relation. Well, I don't know. It depends on what the index is, right?
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Okay.
So you did read the paper, right? I'm just guessing what they should have done, right?
You would not guess the answer, so you have to read.
Fine. Okay. So anyway, but what is amusing is I think everyone's changed their mind now and decided that, look, with this beautiful new observation, if you believe Megorian, right? And we had a lot of discussion about this. Then you might be able to do something about relating to the feedback. And then, of course, you go back to saying, well, if this is true, if this sort of thing is true, then you should see it in the fundamental plane with black hole, right? That is the just the pure engineering type analysis done on principal components of L sigma R and black hole mass will elucidate this. Okay. I wanted to discuss a little bit about fueling in terms of bars within bars, but this is sort of another subject and I need a little more time. So I think what I'll do now is, I mean, I'll be willing to discuss this at lunchtime with people, and perhaps if I stop now and we have a serious discussion, you know, I can throw tomatoes at me, discuss what I've already said, and then we can talk about these other things at lunchtime, if that's all right. Yeah.
Let me ask a homely question.
Yeah, please.
What happened in our galaxy with its rather wimpy black hole? Did the process not go to completion?
Oh, yeah. I think in many of these cases it doesn't go to complete. Let me answer the last part. In many cases it doesn't go to completion.
Yes.
Right? And there's a number of interesting observations of sort of boxy galaxies that Martin Bureau and Ken Freeman have done where it looks like it hasn't actually gone to completion in the spirals, and I suspect the same is true in the ellipticals. In our galaxy, I'm not quite sure. I knew someone would ask this question. I'm not quite sure what happens. I mean, there is some sort of a bar, right? And there is some sort of boxy shaped bulge, you know, and there's certainly a central mass. And the question is, you know, what type is our galaxy? I should, let me go back one more as well. The conventional wisdom is that the type of mechanism that I'm proposing can explain the later type galaxies, that is the sort of SBCs down, right? that you can build bulges that way. There are many ways, of course, to build a bulge, but it would be difficult to see how they would explain the Sombrero galaxy, even though the big structure, even though there is a student in Leiden who wrote a thesis and passed, who used the method to explain the Sombrero. I thought he was taking the theory a little too far. But so in our own galaxy, whether you've had successive episodes, right? I don't actually know, and I don't know whether the numbers work out for such a wimpy little black hole. Right? But remember, I've said black hole throughout this talk, whereas central mass concentration, obviously, it doesn't have to be a relativistic thing, it can do. And it could be that the whole cusp region, with a sufficiently steep power law, could drive this method, this evolution the same way. Yep. So I don't know the answer to the galaxy.
Two questions. I mean, one of the sort of goals in this business is to get a better understanding of the empirical observation, say, the elliptical galaxy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And now the fundamental plane is often dismissed by theorists as, oh, that's just the theory.
Yeah, it isn't.
I think too waxillerical on that. Because
I think Jugovsky showed this in his thesis a long time. It's sort of just the virial theorem, but you do have binding energy going as m to the 1, I can't remember what it was, 1 quarter or something,
right.
M to the... And that, if you look at this, is exactly this.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about it the other day, and I thought, maybe, the fundamental plane... It's interesting because he is binding energy to the 1/5, and that wasn't too far off what Jugovsky got when he looked at this.
So the historical content is the deviation from the...
Yes.
From the virial.
Well, that's what theorists object to. They say the deviation's small and there's not much information. It's just the virial theorem. That's where you get it.
Yeah.
But look at this. I mean, maybe it's important. Yeah.
Okay.
That was one. What was the other one?
I don't remember.
We're both getting old.
Right. Oh.
Okay. Yeah. Right.
I'll come back.
Yep.
Run.
Yeah.
Now, people talk about from galaxies. Usually, they talk about merging galaxies. Various types of.
Yeah.
Classes of galaxies.
Yes.
Now, if these galaxies themselves have black holes in them,
right?
They merge.
Yes.
What would happen to the central region?
Many interesting things. And
that's the question.
Yeah, no. Ah, well, I'm going to say, I wished if I hadn't been diverted by the brilliant discussions every morning at 10. That was one of the things I wanted to address in this talk, but I haven't done so. But I think there are... we did have one discussion about this, and at least one, but one where I was here. There are really interesting constraints on that happening, I suspect, observational constraints, but the theoretical constraints haven't yet been fully worked out. One of the things that's important is whether or not you get hung up at this sort of scale, if they're equal mass, whether you get hung up at a distance of gm over sigma squared and remain there for a long time. Because if you do, I suspect there might be really quite interesting interactions between that stirring and the sort of slightly dipolar potential that's going round and the non-axisymmetric bar type or triaxiality. But nobody's ever worked that out. Nobody's truly looked at the interaction between a wide-ish binary and the type of things I've been doing. Right. Now, why haven't they? Because many people now believe that because you don't see so many wide binaries that you don't get hung up here. This is R against time. So instead of getting hung up there, you actually go rapidly down because the way that you move from here down to the gravitational type radiation scale is when you have essentially loss cone scattering, right? The background is the stars are being scattered out of the orbit of the binary. As they come in, they get scattered out and the energy's lost and the binary hardens. And many people think that, because of the arguments I gave, that there is no loss cone and this actually goes down very rapidly. But and so you go down rapidly to gravitational radiation. In that case, there wouldn't be so many effects. But if this did get hung up for a while, I think there might be some interesting interactions, dynamical interactions between the sort of wide-ish type binary and the other things. But I haven't calculated it yet.
There's no loss cone because...
The arguments are now that there is no loss cone because if there was one, you'd see all these binaries, and B, that there are arguments that, you know, you've got lots of box orbits, or maybe even lots of gas where you can, you know, propagate.
Okay.
Yeah. So Richstone, that was the big difference, and I only understood it after our conversation. And Richstone was talking about it. He'd already assumed there was no loss cone, and that you just evolve biodynamical friction all the way down.
Yeah.
Right? So I was surprised because I last looked at this when I read Beagleman, Blandford and Reese or something on this subject, and actually got hooked up here for quite a while if there was a loss cone and you went down. So I don't think we know yet. I mean, it's a very interesting subject, and I wish I'd done more work on it.
Do you believe the observational constraint, the fact that you believe that?
No, I don't believe any. I mean, I actually think that this whole subject needs serious, some really serious observer, Cormandy or someone, who should go in there and look at, you know, the 100 nearest systems and say, are there any binary? Is there any evidence at all for binarity?
There's limits on binaries.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Greg was thinking a bit about this, and I think that there might be some real surprises there, at least interesting constraints on this. And so I wish I'd done more work on this subject in the last few weeks, but it's a good thing to do. Right.
Do you believe the sort of mucus story that the shape of the light profile in the middle of an elliptical is a marker of whether or not there has been a major merger and so on?
Is this the Faber?
It's
the Faber cusps.
Well, I think also Doug too. I think.
Yeah. No. I mean the whole group.
The word cusp has to be used with care in this context.
No. Well, I'm not sure. I think you should ask Carola to give a talk on this. Right? Get her to come out because she has a lot better data from NICMOS on these things, where you're looking in the red into the central regions and you see a much wider variety of objects than they claim, I think, a bigger dispersion. You know, bars, not bars, cores, not cores, cusps, not cusps. Right? So.
Yeah.
So, you know, she has the best data, NICMOS data at the moment on this. And I'm not quoting her results, but paper should be out soon. Anything else? Gulp.
I'm so lazy that I never bought it in the literature.
You can always ask Roger.
Talking about gas dynamics, is there any explanation for the ubiquity of the antinuclear nuclear torus in the GM?
Well, that's part of this bar in a bar type thing, that they tend to. When you have, let's just sort of do it for the not so in the people who don't spend their time obsessed with these things. That here's the ILR and here's the OLR, and here's sort of co-rotation. It doesn't really matter, and that corresponds to these points on this curve, which is sort of hidden under the pentameter. But this is a curve. This is omega minus kappa over 2, and this is the pattern speed. Okay, and so if you have a bar like this, then inside co-rotation, right, you lose angular momentum to the bar. The gas, which is slightly dissipated, does that. Okay, and the angle gamma is tiny and proportional to the amount of dissipation. Shocks per cycle or something, entropy loss per cycle or something, and so you're losing energy, but this stops when you get to the ILR. So this is where, right. Now these ILRs and OLRs are big, right? They're not your torus size. The question is though, are there inner structures?
How big? What do you mean by big?
Well, let's see, this is 100 10 parsecs, right, 100 parsecs.
Nah.
Well, I mean, it depends on what...
Well, major things, that these things on kiloparsecs. Yeah.
Okay, but wait. Okay, so...
There's a coherent story that we haven't heard yet.
Yeah, wait, the...
Why don't you tell the coherent
story? No, it's not coherent yet. No, there's this whole question of bars within bars.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure about
that. And... Hassan and I are working on this at the moment, and the subject is extremely controversial if you read between the lines. I mean, it was proposed, interesting paper by Schlossman et al. and then Linda Spark did some work on it, but the Geneva group claimed that you would only form bars with the same pattern speed with a response function which was at right angles. That is, that remember there are two families of orbits, B orbits, A orbits, right? And that when you have, when you cross a resonance, and this is getting a bit technical, but when you cross a resonance, you go from the dominant family being this way to that way, right? So you can form a bar, a perpendicular bar. And so Friedli et al., who've done the best simulations, say that you can only form something going with the same pattern speed, which is perpendicular. Okay. And then the most interesting calculation, probably wrong, but was done by Finniger and myself, where we looked at this was the one I threw away for later. We looked at what happened when you had a sort of double bar system where the pattern speed was not the same. Lost it. Sorry. Wait. Where the pattern speed was not the same, and we had sort of dissipative molecular clouds in it. That is, that they were like single particle orbits. But I've lost it. Here. So here's the sort of radius against time. Now in these bars within bars, which are not self-consistent, we put a little bar in the middle of a big bar with a different pattern speed, and you get all sorts of spectacular dynamical behavior. You actually get the gas losing energy and momentum and going straight into the center, right? That solves the problem, if you believe the system is there, right? But you also get other beautiful strange attractor type behavior where they get locked into, because they're dissipative and they're in slightly chaotic Hamiltonian systems, they can get locked into a torus, right? This is a torus. So this is really interesting. So we looked at the observations this year. There are four observations of double bars, and there's no pattern speeds, right? So there's a dearth of data. And another great subject, you know, for people to look at in terms of this fueling argument. Look at in the millimeter, you know, and look at with all sorts of methods on very small scales. Linda Spark has done some work on this and got, I think, fueling, and then Friedli got an opposite answer. So this, it's quite controversial. So not much observations, even though a lot of hype about bars within bars, and even though the single particle calculations can give spectacular effects, it's not clear that those systems are accessible, right? That as you make them, right? So there's a lot of that was what I was going to say anyway. There's a lot of really interesting work to do here as well. So bars within bars, double bars, and binary black holes are, you know, things and feedback.
How do you put dissipation into these?
Oh, we gave each cloud a little gamma, which was equivalent to, you know, if it was gas dynamics, a little drag, right? Which was equivalent to, you know, entropy lost per orbit sort of thing in a shock. And that worked well in elucidating this effect. You know, there were a number of PhD theses where they put in slight drag on particles and found that, you know, you would form inner rings, etc. And we were looking for effects like that, so we didn't think it was such a bad thing to do. Just first up.
Yeah, the student yelled a bit.